Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 53 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show.
So, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Randy George, and I play bass for the Neil Morse Band, amongst other things.
And here we are in Montreal live, which is very strange for me. I don't normally do live, but I was super excited you were coming to town. I'm super excited you agreed to do this.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to. I'm here. Why not?
We're here. Let's do this. So, I want to do a bit of the backstory because I know I've heard you tell it maybe once or twice. 6 years old-ish, you started playing some piano. And around 12, you switched to bass. But there's one is I found 12 exceptionally young to play bass. And I was very curious about that. And you didn't sort of meander about it before. And I want you to meander a little bit. Where are you at 12 years old that you see the bass? What attracts you to it?
Yeah, well, I guess, I like most kids at, 6 or 7, you get forced to take piano lessons, which I'd go across the street to the convent and some nun started teaching me right. Basics. That didn't last very long, of course, because like most kids, they make terrible students. Right. I think what happened was when I was 12 is when I got my first bass, and I had asked for that for Christmas. But what inspired me to want a bass, which was rather silly, but I was a big Moody Blues fan starting at about 8 or 9 years old. And
So let's stop there. How does one at 8 or 9, because I have kids in that age range, get exposed to the Moody Blues? And then being an 8 or 9-year old at that time, be like, this is the thing I like.
Yeah. I had siblings who were, 7 and 10 years older than me. So that was probably a big part of it. The records in the house were Beatles and Beach Boys and Monkees and Love and Spoonful, right? And then my sister got into all the late 60s teeny boppers, David Cassidy and Bobby Sherman and all that kind of stuff. And right about 1970... This is very odd how I came across the Moody Blues. We were at a Safeway store, and there was a point of purchase display for an album by some band called The Tribes. They weren't anything or anybody, and their album was nothing but covers.
And this is weird. This is back in Denver? But are we in Denver now?
Lakewood, Colorado, a western suburb of Denver, yes. And so I don't know why we bought this dumb album, but we did, and they had covered Question. I heard the song, and I thought, oh, this is a really cool song. And I, of course, asked my brother, and he said, oh, yeah, this is the Moody Blues. So I went to the store, and I bought a Question of Balance. And from there, I just really got into the Moody Blues somehow. I eventually got all that original back catalog. So what really inspired me to want to pick up the bass was a picture of John Lodge on the back of In Search of the Lost Chord. Perfect. I liked the guitar with the big giant headstock with the four big tuning keys on one side. That was cool to me.
Okay.
It was the tuning keys that made me want a bass.
It was a Fender.
Yeah, it was a Fender Precision Bass, right. And I knew nothing about playing bass. I understood it from playing piano. I understood that the bass, had a lower tone, and you play one note at a time, so to speak, is kind of how it was described to me, versus a guitar which had 6 whole strings, and that may seem really complicated to me, especially since you had to play more than one note.
But even at that age, like now, again, I've got kids in that age range, when they talk about learning music, they shift to piano because they say it's in front and it's very visual, the sort of white and black. And they actually talk you out of guitar because they talk about how you got to sort of like lean over the neck and just the fretting. There's a frustration with maybe not having the grip and the strength to get the note right. And so like hearing you at that age pick up a bass is like a very, to me, like, wow, like that's one is, were your parents musical? Were they at all encouraging this?
Yeah, my dad was a singer, and he had quite a voice. He was very much a crooner, a la Frank Sinatra, that kind of era. That was his thing. He was very good at it, but he wasn't necessarily a musician per se, as much as just a singer. He had a natural ability to sing. But he encouraged me to learn about music and to learn how to do it right. I just didn't see the piano as being cool. I thought it's like, well, I don't really see this. How does this actually translate to a band? And I get that there's piano in a lot of bands, and it is an indispensable instrument in most bands. But at the time, it seemed lame to me. It seemed like, you know, I don't want to just be one of these guys that I can't play rock and roll on a piano. At 8 years old, those are the kind of things that you're processing, you know. How do I, or not, rather, I should say at 12 years old. But, you know, I knew what I wanted to do, and I thought it would really be cool to get a bass. And they bought me a Fender Music Master bass.
That's a good start.
Yeah, Fender Music Master bass and an amp combo for Christmas in 1974. And, of course, the first thing I did was I played in church. You know, they had me playing in the Catholic Church at that time.
So what was the gap between you get the bass, it's Christmas, that you're like, okay, I can do this, I'm going to play live? Or is it like, go forth, young man, you're 12, like you're in the church. Like everyone needs a bass player at that age, I'm sure.
Well, it's one of those things where you get the thing. And of course, I had to take lessons because that was part of the deal. And so I went to the music store where he bought the stuff, and there was a guy there teaching. He was a cool cat.
Was he a bass player or guitar player who would teach
bass? Guitar player, okay, teaching bass.
All important questions here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but he certainly knew how to play a bass, and he'd pick it up, you know, and I'm looking at that thinking, oh, man, you know, it's like I get it, but I don't know how to do that. But he taught me some basics, but somehow I found my own way. I, you know, started playing along with Moody Blues Records. And then, you know, right around that same time, well, I got to back up. Before, that's when I got into the Moody Blues, was like 1970. That was before I actually had the bass. But I also, you know, Roundabout had become a hit, and I heard that, and so I fell in love with that. And that, too, was very intriguing to me, so... Yeah, so these are things that started getting me interested in playing. And once I had the bass, I started putting on those records and just sort of playing along and trying to find notes. And it just sort of came to me naturally. I don't really remember exactly, because I sure as heck didn't, you know, stick with those lessons very long.
Was that music, though, divergent from what your siblings were doing? Like, I think back to my age there, and... I believe that like 10, 11, 12 are really formative years for people who love music, because it's either a sibling or that's just sort of like, I think the frontal lobe is just ready for that sort of thing. So if your sister, I believe you said, was listening to David Cassidy, is it strange? Like when you think back, is it strange at a 12 years old, you're listening to Yes and Moody Blues? Because it seems strange to me, but maybe in the times that was just incredibly popular music, was it?
It was, you know, they were being played on the radio pretty regularly.
Because we think about the 70s, we think disco. Like if you weren't...
Well, late 70s, early 70s was dominated by prog. Right. You know, and Roundabout got a lot of airplay. Question got a lot of airplay. Genesis. At the time. Genesis wasn't, not in America, not in 1970.
Right,
or,
it was later.
But that, yeah, all that happened later. For me, it was Yes and Moody Blues, pretty much. Yeah. And then somewhere right along the way in that same era, even before I got my first bass, my brother dumped a few albums on me. I think he gave me like Neil Young Harvest, Led Zeppelin Houses of the Holy, and ELP Brain Salad Surgery.
You're done there. That's it. You're done.
Right. Well, so he gave me those, and then I got like Deep Purple, Machine Head, and Made in Japan, and you know, I had all this stuff that, you know, and I didn't like it. I mean, it's like I hated Neil Young at the time. It's like, oh, I don't like this album, but you know, I didn't want to seem, you know, I didn't want to be mean about it and say, oh, so, you know, I don't want to hear this, you know. But I just didn't listen to it, even though I like a lot of songs on that album now. But at the time, it wasn't quite, you know, what I was after. Brain Salad Surgery was quite intriguing. I thought that was interesting because it had some really quirky material on it. House of the Holy took a little longer for me to catch on to as well. But I was already familiar with the Beatles and the Monkees at that time. So McCartney's solo stuff started to filter into my world. And I got albums like Band on the Run and Ram and things like that.
At that point, was Chris Squire's stuff something you could play, or was that stuff where it was more aspirational? Were you like picking the instrument up where you were like, I got this?
Kind of. I'm starting to figure out Roundabout. It took a few years. Once I got my first bass, it took a couple years to really, grasp how to play it and how to find my way around. I understood music. I understood chord changes because of the piano lessons. So it wasn't really hard to assimilate into things like church music and Christmas specials where we were doing, you know, the Catholic Church and their modern take on Christmas carols. I remember sitting in Mass and they do the Our Father, and they had this rockin' version of the Our Father, and I found that the roundabout bass line would work in it. I would sit there playing the roundabout bass line, you know, Our Father who art, and they loved it. They didn't know what to think, because I don't think they'd ever seen anything like it. So I got nothing but compliments from people, when by all rights they should have said, well, are you nuts, kid? What are you doing? You know.
So then at what age do the peers start coming out? Like, I remember when I started playing, I was probably, let's call it 14. And the minute the words "I play bass" came out of my mouth, everyone was like, we need a bass player. Like, was it as frenetic for you? I almost call it, it was like chum. You throw some chum in the water and all the fish come biting.
Well, not right away. I got my first bass in 74, but it was probably 76 before I got the first call from some friends who wanted me to join their band. They had a gig at some elementary school, you know, with a set list that included, it was only six songs. I can't remember all of them though, but I remember we did Smoke on the Water, Never Been to Spain, Obla Di Obla Da.
I think bands that are formed today still do Smoke on the Water. I think that's just...
Oh, and of course, at the time, I actually kind of soloed in it
right.
on bass. Okay. They'd never seen anything like it either. And the guitar players in the band couldn't solo. So, you know, they didn't even have any way to solo.
There's a couple of things I'm so curious about. You know, one is you start in this choir, I guess, through the church or the band, church band. And it seems to me like if I were to look at the mountaintops of that... of Agilon and the Neil Morse band, like that Christianity thing sort of, it's, I mean, although Neil yeah. is, it's interesting that there's sort of always been that sort of spirited faith in you.
Well, you know, I was raised Catholic up to a point till, you know, once I got into high school and whatnot, which is when I was mostly playing, you know, like from 76 through 78, 79, the church stuff. And then I kind of stopped doing that. But, and then, of course, in high school, we formed bands. Every year in high school, I had a different lineup, and we were doing all kinds of rock songs, you know, Rolling Stones and Bachman Turner Overdrive and, yeah, you know, Blue Oyster Cult, all the stuff of the day. And I learned a lot of stuff then, and I started to branch out. Of course, at that time, you know, having been Catholic, you know, I was obviously very against anything religion because, you know, they just sort of shove it down your throat. And
And the time and being young and a musician back then probably wasn't really aligned with that lifestyle.
But I knew it was different. There were things that I didn't like that a lot of kids liked that I think were a little more on the rebellious side. I tended to gravitate to more of the artistic side. That's why Yes was such a big favorite. Right. Then Queen came out, Kansas came, it got popular at that time, and I really got into them. Rush came out. I wasn't so much into Rush at first.
Yeah, but. I mean, we're in Canada, so you got to be careful. We can't talk too loud about this, but... It's amazing to me that if there was Yes in Moody Blues, that there was something in Rush that you were like, nah, not for me. Like, I'm always fascinated by how Sarah Silverman, the comedian, talks about, like, I don't judge my ear holes. And I'm always like, I don't have guilty pleasures. I'm fine with everything I listen to. But I find that amazing that, like, someone like you, based off of the sort of arc of where you were going, you heard Rush, you're like, nah, I don't like it.
Yeah, it was too...
Nasally?
too rock. Yeah, his voice at first was a little weird and... The first Rush song that I really got familiar with was Spirit of the Radio, because right. they played that a lot. And I thought, oh, man, this guitar solo is awful. You know, he's just shredding a bunch of notes and noise, and there's nothing musical about
right.
it. That was what I was thinking at the time.
Right.
And this is my own failing. There was nothing wrong with Rush because, you know, obviously, like so many, you know, I did a 180, and they became one of my very favorite bands, including all the material I first didn't take to.
Right.
I even saw the Hemispheres tour, so, you know, I
in Denver?
Yeah, I saw it live.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and they sounded just like the record. That's what blew my mind, right. Is they sounded exactly like the record. So it was really quite amazing to see. I still can remember that show quite well. And then, yeah, after Moving Pictures came out, that sort of turned me on. I don't know why it was Moving Pictures, but that seems to be a common tale for a lot of people in Rush.
Yeah, and then the minute the keyboards got too much, it's the bail point for many, and then they come back, I think, to sort of appreciate the entire career cycle is what happened.
I don't make any apologies, but Power Windows and Hold Your Fire are probably my two favorite Rush albums.
So same, like, I mean, I was born in 71, so for me it was that, I would say 83 was a really critical year for me.
They changed. You know, they went 80s, so yeah. Starting with right about Signals. And I loved everything they did. There wasn't anything I didn't like about what they did. I really loved Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures a lot. And, you know, basically everything from 2112 forward, I finally really, about 2112 to Presto would be my, like, those are my favorite albums. Everything before, okay, you know, I liked Fly By Night, but some of it was just a little too straight-ahead rock for my tastes at the time. And then the stuff they did after that just tended to gravitated away from the part of the Rush that I really liked. Even though as time has gone on, I start to see it more. I start to see more of this, you know, hear more of the same thing in it, as opposed to seeing a shift in, oh, okay, this isn't as good as this. You know, I didn't like Counterparts for the longest time, but then, you know, I realized, well, this is as good as any other Rush album. You know, once you become an adult, your mind opens up, and you, with a lot of other influences and whatnot, you just broaden your scope and understanding of what you're hearing. So, yeah. But when you're a kid, you get to be really picky about things for no stupid reason whatsoever.
You know? Yeah, I mean, for me, it was like I was a metal guy, and you couldn't really get me to listen to much. But at the time, when I was playing, there was obviously people like Jaco and Stanley Clarke, and you get exposed to that. And my parents were big into jazz and classical, so that came. And then you study music. Like, you realize it after. You're sort of wearing the studs and the jean jacket, but you realize you're listening to so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was a big fan of Stanley Clarke. And you know, I know Jaco was an amazing player, but he's never been one of those guys for me. It just wasn't my thing.
Wait, are you into fusion?
Yeah, I was into guys like Anthony Jackson and Abe Laboriel, you know, and Stanley Clarke. Those were the guys that were really doing Percy Jones.
But not down. Berlin. But not down the Chick Corea Weather Report thing? That was not your thing?
Probably because it was a little too mainstream at the time. I got really into that kind of stuff toward the end of the 80s is when I really started to really appreciate that kind of stuff as more so. It was a little too jazzy for me, unless there was some kind of shredding solo in it that a gravity. But I was looking for the shred somewhere in it. And if I didn't hear that, it just, I don't know, for some reason my brain was just not quite developed enough to appreciate it at the time.
So talk to me about your life in terms of, okay, great, you go through elementary school, high school, you're playing. At what point are you a professional bass player? At what point are you, this is what I'm doing professionally? Did you not do that for a long time and only come to it with sort of the work you were doing on your own? Like, at what point are you sort of a professional bass player? This is what I do music.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd always wanted to be in a band, and I'd always wanted to be a musician. I think there just came a point in life, and this for me would probably be about the mid-80s, you know, and I met a girl and decided to get married, and I thought, I need to have a career that I can make money. So I did what most kids did back then. You go to school for computer technology because you can take a vocational course and then you get hired, and you know, you can make a lot of money if you get in on the ground. You're getting on the ground floor of all those things like networking and all kinds of stuff. So I did that, and lo and behold, you know, at that time, I was actually willing to depart from that whole dream of playing music for a living to find something that was more realistic. But the funny thing is that taking a basic electronics course only reinforced my love of music, because I think basic electronics should be required for every musician. It's the physics of what you do. It really is. It's the physics of tone. It's the physics of frequency. It's the physics of understanding sound. It's all fundamentally wrapped up in basic electronics. And then, of course, with the digital age coming upon us, sequencing. And it wasn't long after that that I come out of that thinking I'm going to go into computer technology. And then lo and behold, I go and buy Cakewalk, you know, and a MIDI interface and a keyboard sampler. And all of a sudden, I have this computerized studio, which I can create music with. And so I started writing a lot of music at that point.
But are you working full-time in IT tech, or are you doing both? What's happening professionally?
Yeah, I did for a little while. You know, jobs like that for a few years here, a few years there. Okay. I never really got with a company and stayed with them for a really long period of time just because I never wanted to do that. I never wanted to be a get up and go to work every day kind of guy. I want to play music. That's what I told myself. And I've always been a firm believer in you have to believe that you are what you want to be. And you have to live your life according to what you want to be if you want it to happen. Otherwise, it's just going to be talk and dreams that never come to any fruition.
All right. And so tell me a little bit about what happens at that point, because you have this band Agilon, and in a very, I think, strange twist of fate. I mean, when you read it on paper, it sounds strange that Rick Wakeman from Yes somehow gets connected to you, which is strange if you consider going back to Moody Blues. And Yes, that's got to be what happens. Is it you reach out to him? They reach out to you? How does that come about?
Well, he had we'd read in a magazine. He was talking about his Hope Records and that he had started this records and they were actively looking for bands to bring on board. And my singer had seen this and he came running in and, hey, check this out. You know, da, 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 we got to send him a tape. We had just done, you know, started our first album, which we'd only released on cassette.
Right.
Okay. And
this is what year? This is what year?
Okay. Now, this would be probably 94, 95. Okay.
You know, so we survived the 80s.
The 80s. Well, I moved from Denver to Seattle in 92 in a strange twist of fate. Largely, again, because I felt like, number one, I want to be a pro, so I need to go somewhere where there seems to be things happening in the music world. And in the early 90s, Seattle seemed to be the hot spot. And I got up there and realized, you know, I found out really quick that they weren't any more interested in the kind of music I wanted to do there than they would be anywhere else. If you sounded like crap, you would thrive. Mm-hmm. People pack out those clubs to hear bands that were just awful. And that was the Seattle scene. And it's like, well, I'm not going to do that, you know. But nonetheless, every time you relocate, you reestablish yourself. And it gives you a chance to reestablish yourself the way you want people to see and know you. And so, you know, that's what I did. And I came up there to record music, and that's exactly what I ended up doing. And at first, just my own stuff. But then I met William, and we started Agilon. And so, yeah, so we had written a bunch of songs, and we recorded them, and I sent it to Rick Wakeman. And lo and behold, he actually listened to the tape and seemed to really love what he was hearing, because evidently he gets a lot of tapes, but most of them aren't anything that he would be able to use to sign to a label and actually sell to anybody. You know, there's so much. And you have to weed through it all to find those gems that are sitting out there. And I think that to him, that's what this was. He said he listened to it three times that day just to be sure that he wasn't, just to be sure he was hearing what he believed he was hearing.
It seems like one of those moments where if all else fails, you can go to bed happy knowing that that happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was very thrilled, and basically he sends us this letter, which started out very encouraging because he really loved it. You know, Agilon is just the sort of band I'd love to have on my label. But, you know, you also have to understand that our label is in its infancy and yada, yada, this and yada, that. And I'm fully prepared for him to say, keep in touch. You know, we'd maybe like to work with you guys in the future. That's what I'm expecting. But by page three, he's like, and lastly, if you're amicable, we'd like to maybe change the title of the CD to this because we think it has a better appeal, you know, this song as opposed to that song. You know, and I'm like, you know, he wants to put it out. So it's like, well, okay. So he, you know, we signed a deal with him, and he put out the CD and ended up being album of the week on all five national UK radio networks. And then they made an attempt to get it into America, which kind of, you know, like so many deals, falls short because done on a handshake with one guy who says one thing, and then when it actually comes down, nobody seems to remember what was talked about. And then they don't know what to do because, well, here we have all this stuff. We don't know what to do with it. And there's a balance due, you know, stuff like that. And it's like, well, so, you know, he gave it a good shot, but I think he got us out in front of the Yes audience enough to, you know, have made it, you know, a reasonable debut. And then he played on our second album. He did some guest spots, which helped. And then by then, you know, between Spock's Beard and the Flower Kings and all the other prog bands that were still in the UK throughout the 90s, that resurgence of prog that happened in 94, we sort of hopped on that. And that just sort of grew and grew.
So one thing that I'm curious about is guitar sort of became more prominent for you. Is that true for the Agilon stuff? Was it?
Yeah. At the time, you know, William was able to play bass, and so I felt like guitar was a new territory for me to really conquer. I hadn't played a lot of guitar before then, but I started in the early 90s, and I found it a great opportunity to become a better guitar player and to sink my teeth into something. William had some very interesting things that he had written that I found challenging to play, so I kind of liked adopting the guitar role in Agilon and letting Will play bass because the songs weren't that technically crazy.
Right.
So it wasn't all that, you know, the bass wasn't all that busy or anything. Right. And that worked really well for him. His style, you know, worked out very nicely. And then it gave me a chance to spread my wings as a guitarist a little bit and a keyboard player.
And so when do you fall back in love with the bass? Like, how does it come back to you?
Well, you know, oddly enough, I didn't ever just drop the bass. I recorded most of the bass in the Agilon albums too. I had just, you know, I'd just been more interested in writing songs for Agilon and trying to be more of a songwriter as opposed to an instrumentalist. So it didn't really go away. I just started doing more. I had keyboards, I had guitars, so I started doing everything, putting things together. But it wasn't until, of course, I connected with Neil that I, you know, said, well, you know, as a bass player, clearly I can probably bring more to the table. It wouldn't be hard to find a better guitar player, and it certainly wouldn't be hard to find a better keyboard player. So as a bassist, I probably have the most to offer. And so when I finally figured out that they were looking for a bass player, it was like, well, this is a no-brainer.
So what year is that, and how do you meet Neil?
Well, that was probably 2003, although in about 2001 thereabouts, I think I sent him a CD of some of my stuff.
Solo stuff or Agilon or both?
Mostly, I think, solo stuff, because I wanted to work with Neil when I heard his announcement that he was leaving Spock's Beard and Transatlantic. And
you weren't the only one, I'm told. When he announced that, the people were like, grab that guy.
Yeah. And then he went off and disappeared and did Testimony. And right about the time he finished the album and it was mixed, and a few months before the release, I called him about being involved on the next Agilon album, which I was going to try to get him to sing a vocal on. And we just started talking, and it went from there, you know. And that's how I finally figured out, you know, we started talking about what he was doing and where he was at with his touring band. And, of course, then he finally revealed that, well, what we really need is a bass player. I'm like, well, there you go. That's a no-brainer. So he sent me Testimony. I sent him the Agilon record I wanted to sing on, yada, yada. And I think he liked it. And, you know, I told him, yeah, Rick Wakeman's doing this and that on it. And he came back and said, you need to get that guy on a real organ. But, yeah, he seemed pretty impressed by it. And I think he was also really impressed because he was so new to going solo to express his Christianity and his faith through his lyrics. I think he was impressed to see a band that had already done that and just how in your face our lyrics actually were. I don't think he was sure at that point exactly how overt he could be or should try to be doing that. So I think in a lot of ways I brought a little bit of a mentoring with regard to how to phrase lyrics in a way that doesn't sound too trite, but doesn't also convolute the message.
It's interesting to me because not being of that faith and being exposed to so many bands as a music journalist back then, there was a sort of a thought that those bands are sort of like don't have real lyrics, that there's not that sort of same type of punchy music. And then in the 90s, I think something did happen. And there was that sort of shift where bands would be Christian type music bands or Christian music bands that it almost was the second part. It wasn't the first part that you said about them. And yet here you guys were doing it a little bit before that and very overtly, as you said. And I'm wondering, how conscious was that for you? Like, how were you looking around going, look, no one's doing it like this, we can do it like this? Or were you simply just being you and it just so happened to have that sort of Christian theme to it?
Oh, it was probably a little bit of both. Obviously, nobody was doing it, so we felt we had nothing to lose. And we also felt free because we were Christians and at that time fairly new in terms of, you know, the full-on church type Christians.
Right.
I think we felt free. I think we didn't feel that there were any of these rules you have to follow like you would in mainstream music, and you don't have the confines and the roadblocks. And we thought, well, we're just free to just write how we want to write.
Because as a listener, I mean, I'm sure you could see how, like, it did feel like, well, it all has to be watered down would be the sort of thing you would hear. And then you listen to your music, and it's like, it's the complete opposite of
well,
that.
Well, quite naively, we actually thought that the church, the people in church, other Christians would really enjoy it. And some did. There was a lot of them that had listened to that kind of music, and there's tons more out there that we didn't know at that time, but there were a few. But for the most part, people in church weren't all that supportive of us because the songs were long. I think they appreciated what the lyrics were saying.
Well, people weren't fans of progressive for that reason.
Yeah, and they want something they could, and they like to participate. They have no ability to sit and pay attention. Unless it's a pastor preaching some kind of convoluted message that may or may not even be right. But nonetheless, you know, you give them good music, and you know, it's like we did an Iona song in church one time, and the gal singing seemed to think that during the sax solo, or maybe it was the guitar solo, there's a solo section which didn't go very long. Instead of just playing the solo, she felt like she had to do something to fill the space.
Right.
Because people...
Let's get active here.
Yeah, what? People don't know what to do with music alone without lyrics, you know? And we just get tired of all that kind of mentality. And we basically just, you know, we said, well, we're just going to do what we do. You know, we'll find an audience. And, you know, with Rick, we figured that a lot of the Yes fans would probably enjoy it to some degree. Of course, you know, again, we were very naive as well,
yeah.
You know, because we nobody supported progressive music anyway, and let alone Christians. We thought we'd get away with it. But I think there was more shock value because we were creative. Right. You know, there's a lot of Christian bands out there trying to do their original music, and it all sounded like cheesy Christian music.
Right.
Like it's you expect.
Right.
Nobody sounded like us. We were intense. And we were intense and moody, and they didn't know quite what to do with it. But the people who get it loved it. And people who didn't get it, I don't know, they just weren't very supportive of it. So
it's also interesting to me that when I think about what's happened with Neil Morris and the sort of iterations it's gone through, it seems to be, well, it's the Neil Morris band now, at the core there really is you and Mike Portnoy as sort of that trio with Neil. How do you speak to the dynamics of that? And when you think about that and the sort of trajectory of the band, which is now, I guess, 15 years or almost 16 years now, what do you do as a bass player to add to that type of energy?
Well, the years that we spent working on the albums, I wrote a lot of lyrics on one.
Yeah.
And some music stuff. And it wasn't just bass, you know. I mean, I had keyboard ideas and guitar ideas. And, you know, some albums Neil had pretty well put together, like Question Mark. I think I made one lyrical change on Question Mark, but I did add one musical passage. But there wasn't a lot that needed done. Mike didn't even really feel like it needed anything, like that we needed to change the arrangement or whatever. We did a little bit of that with Sola, slicing and dicing mostly, but everything was already there. Lifeline, you know, these are albums that Neil had pretty well written. We didn't have to add a lot other than just to come in and do what we normally do, which was more of a producer role versus versus a collaborative role in the actual writing. Neil had most of the writing done, so we just came in and produced the albums.
But the musicality of the bass in this music, to me, speaks more than just the sort of hum that connects the rhythm section to the lead section. And I guess what I'm really curious about is, put the production away, the songwriting, the creative inputs that you're doing as a player, how does that change your DNA a little bit in terms of being able to add to that, knowing that there's a lot going on and that the expectation on the vibe is that there's going to be a lot going on? It's not just going to be sort of riding the E into infinity here.
Well, you know, to be fair, Neil sent demos of everything before we'd show up to the studio, so we had a time to get to know it. I found a lot of times Neil would just be doing keyboard, bass, and left hand on things that I assumed was electric bass.
Right.
And then I got to the studio and I actually soloed up his original demo bass tracks. And instead of, you know, instead of him going, he's going doom 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 doom.
So it's more traditional than you had thought.
Well, he just didn't. When he demos his stuff, the keyboards were always first and foremost. I just assumed the bass was doing some of the stuff that it was doing. So I learned it and played it. And that's kind of how I just, you know, it's like, well, the bass should be playing this, you know. Don't keep burying the bass with a bunch of keyboards doing the same line. Not that that helped, but, you know, he still does that. He still does that unless I, you know, get with Rich and say, no, there's too much of that going on. Take it down below the bass. Make sure the bass is in front of it. But, you know, it sounds good, you know, to a certain degree when you got the keyboards following the bass. It gives it a big sound, especially in a ballad thing. There's not a lot, you know, shreddy notes going on, so it's not as big of a deal. But a lot of it was just my interpretation of what he was doing, and I just assumed that that's what he wanted out of the bass. That's what everybody was doing in progressive rock. You know, you look at Dream Theater, and the bass is doubling all the lines. It's like I just assumed that's what he wanted. So that's kind of what, and that's the way I played anyway. So it was kind of natural for me to arrive at that place. And that's what Chris Squire did. And yes, it wasn't just a bridge between the rhythm and the melody. It was a part, and all the parts have to work together to make the whole. And that's kind of exactly how Neil's music is. All the parts have to work together to create the whole.
When you think about how new albums come together, and I think, you know, I was listening to The Great Adventure, and I was wondering to myself, I've been with bands and artists for 30 plus years, myself interviewing them, magazines, stuff like that. And I've often heard in the studio or recording this, it's a great song, but that's not a Metallica song. That's not how. And when I think of progressive music, which I love so much, and Neil Moore's band, is that one of those, we call it in business, the curse of knowledge, where it's like you almost know too much about what you know so that you can't see all the other stuff that people may not know, and you speak it as if everyone knows this, but they don't. Do you look at the music and think sometimes you are sort of in that corner of there's an expectation that the Neil Morse band's going to play this way, that progressive music is now in this place where people want it like this, or do you feel free because of the real roots of progressive, which was to not be this? That's a very convoluted way of asking, is there more creativity and openness, I guess?
Well, I think there always is, but you're always going to hit roadblocks with the individuals and who and what they are and what they bring to the table. I've many times tried to bring the more fusion-y vibe in with Neil and Mike, and neither one of them gets that kind of music very well.
Mike did Liquid Tension Experiment, which was...
Well, I don't call that fusion. That's heavy. As far as I'm concerned, it's heavy metal. It's very shreddy, and it's progressive because it's, you know, not a rock format. But it's not fusion like Brand X. Brand X is fusion, right? If we're going to establish some guidelines. When I think of, like you said, the freedom of the creativity, I'm thinking of things that might sound a little a bit like Brand X.
Okay.
Neil would never go there musically, because it's not what he does, and Mike doesn't really go there because it's not what he does. It's not that they can't play it, they could, but it just isn't really what they do. And you find that, you know, Neil and Mike work the way they work, and you just kind of have to meet them where they're at. You all kind of meet in the middle, and so it's never going to be exactly maybe as far to the left or the right as you had hoped to go with it, because they're always going to pull you right back to where they're at in the middle. And so to a certain extent, you know, what comes out, it just becomes a product of who we are, right. You know. Whereas if I were in control and writing something, I might go from one style to another in great degrees and expect everybody to follow, right. Regardless of whether it's natural for them to or not. It is for me, so I just assume somebody else should be able to find their way in. But that's just sort of optimistic thinking, because you almost always have to find people where they're at and figure out how you intersect with them. And it may not always be what you think, even if you know what to expect. I got Rick Wakeman to play on my stuff, and he gave me exactly what he asked for. But when I was sitting there with it all, I had to do a lot to make it fit.
It reminds me of, I watched Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time the other day, and there's a part where Freddie Mercury goes away and does his own solo stuff. And when he comes back to the band, he says, you know, I had all these world-class musicians in the studio, and they did exactly what I said, and that was the problem, that yeah. There wasn't that sort of back-and-forth tension. And as you were saying that, it reminded me of that.
Yeah, and that I think is responsible for a great deal of the magic in the Neil Morse band, is that there are just things that happen, and I don't always like a change. And Neil said, oh, I think we should just like go from here to here and just make it short and sweet and not have all that, and you know, I'm just not feeling it. And I'm like, well, I'm feeling it. I think it's cool, right. You know. But, you know, in hindsight, when you get done with it, it becomes what it becomes, and you accept it for that. I don't look at it like, well, I wish it had been that, or I wish it had been this. I just accept that this is who we are, this is what we arrived at, and you just have to accept that. And embrace it, because that is what's honest, right. You know.
As a player, I'm curious, I think about the complexity of the live show, and then I think about the complexity of an album like The Great Adventure, and how challenging are they for you as a player? Is it as challenging as recording it as it is trying to get ready for a tour like this? Like, do you find them just different planes? How do you look at it?
You mean recording the album first?
Recording and live? Yeah, and how you prep for it.
Well, like an album like Sola Scriptura, I had the demos in advance, so I just sat and learned it the same way I would learn it to play live, yeah. Because you want to go in the studio and be able to play it. You don't want to have to spend time. But at the same time, like with the last three or four albums, I did a lot of it at home. I didn't do it at Neil's studio, so I wasn't under as much of a time restraint to get everything recorded. But, you know, you just go along and you play along with it. And I play what comes naturally to me. But sometimes you have to find what's right for the part. It isn't always going to be what you think. And sometimes I find that where I wanted to be a little more busy and complicated, that it worked better when I simplified it. And versus places where I was being too simple and realized I could actually stretch out more, and it worked better. So, you know, it's a trial and error. It's all trial and error. Lately, the last two albums with Similitude and with this one, we kind of came out of doing the album to going right into the tour, basically. So it was all still pretty fresh. So it came together pretty quick. But you also have to be able to perform it. It's different when you're recording, because you can record the section without necessarily having to get there and be ready when you get to that section. And you find that when you're trying to perform it live, it's a bit more of a physical prowess that needs to happen. And you have to build the endurance to, like, you know, make the muscle memory work so that when you hit that section, you can just launch right into it and play it, because you don't have to record it that way, but you do have to play it live that way. So there's a little bit of another level that happens after the album's recorded. And like, there's things that I do that come naturally that I wish, you know, if I went back, I'd probably have recorded this or that little thing, maybe a little different, because live I ended up doing it differently. And that could be because of somebody else doing, you know, something differently, or, you know, Mike, you're playing to the drums, and he doesn't remember every single fill that he did. But if I did something that worked with a specific drum fill, and then he plays something completely different, then all of a sudden my little figure sitting out there, and it doesn't work. And so either I have to point it out and say, hey, can we connect and do this bit like this here? Or I have to modify to allow for him just sort of to play whatever he's going to play and not follow that particular figure. So, you know, there's always stuff like that. So the music undergoes a whole nother level of development when it comes time to playing it live, because it's easy, like I said, it's easy just to lay it all out there in a recording, because you can do everything one bit at a time.
Right.
But live, you have to be able to perform it. And
this is the curse.
It comes with its challenges.
It's the curse that a lot of friends who are 80s metal singers, and they're like, that's the curse, is not thinking like, when I'm 50, will I be able to do this? The answer is no.
And you do start to approach the albums thinking about, well, I'm going to have to be able to play it live. Yeah. And so, you know, and I do that. And then Neil will want to, hey, can you do this here? Oh, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And then come to find out, well, but I can't do it like that live. You know, or else you're going to have to cover the bass pedals, like, because I can't change to that sound and hit the downbeat of the bass pedal. I can't do it both at the same time. So sometimes you have to find ways to make things work if you want to achieve the same result.
Last area that I'm curious about is just the sort of state of progressive music. I think about things like Cruise to the Edge, which I know you guys took part in. I think about the fact that you're releasing albums, many other bands releasing albums. There seems to be an even more of a gelling from rock bands to harder rock bands in progressive. I'm of the feeling that Sirius XM at any point in time will probably do a progressive rock station. It just sort of feels like the natural next thing they would do. How do you see the state of it? Do you look at it and go, wow, it's a really healthy state, progressive music? Do you think it's still in that sort of awkward niche thing where thousands of people get on the Cruise to the Edge, but it's not widely accepted? How do you see it?
Well, I see it as it's become its own thing. The people who grew up with it never forgot it, and they reached an age where they realized they could do something about it. And so we have a huge, huge underground market that surfaced and became its own thing we've created, because it's now, you know, the people who are responsible for doing things like Cruise to the Edge or Sirius XM are people of that generation now who say, you know, there's still a lot of people who really love this music. Just because the mainstream doesn't get it or it doesn't work in mainstream formats, you know, we don't live in that world anymore. And I think the music world at large plays a big factor in where maybe progressive music sits today, because I think that record labels have been scrambling for the last two decades to try and figure out how to continue to operate, because the paradigm no longer worked once the internet came up. And yet, on the other hand, the internet gave prog bands like myself and on a lot of these guys, it gave us all an opportunity to do for ourselves what the record label used to do for you, except without the money. But at the same time, yeah, we found that we could be our own marketing platform, and now you have cruises, themed cruises. You know, whoever saw that coming? But once they stumbled onto it, it blew up, you know? So yeah, I think as long as people love the music, yeah, but it's going to be tougher. It's still tough to get it into a mainstream outlet of some kind. Or not.
Maybe it never will be, and this is just sort of it. There's just people falling into it, they like it, and this is your mainstream. It's this.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take things like Sirius XM doing a progressive rock station. It'd be nice if Access TV would devote a little more to the progressive rock scene. Sure, they play the Yes, you know, videos. They'll deal with anything heritage. But, you know, there's so many newer bands out there that are just really spectacular. And there's a lot of talent. There's a ton of prog bands. There's as many prog bands as there are any other kind of music. Yeah. The problem is there's a whole wash of them and many of them just sound the same. And there's, to stand out in that realm, there's just got to be something unique about it that people just gravitate to. It's happened for a few people in recent years. Like Haken has really come out of the woodwork and grown quite a bit. But of course, they have that sound, and a lot of the progressive genre has gravitated to the heavier, you know, which is what Dream Theater established. And even Dream Theater really never got their due from the mainstream world, you know, and they were selling out arenas, which goes to show that, do you even need the mainstream world?
Well, that's what I was saying. You know, I think the mainstream
become, because the people who like that kind of stuff, they won't like your music even if it was being played.
Right.
That's the thing. They still want to hear Justin Bieber, or they still want to hear, I don't know, whatever.
I don't think he's cool anymore, but yeah.
You know, whatever. You know what I mean? They want young kids. I mean, I watched my daughter grow up, and I watched exactly, you know. Right. She grew up listening to a lot of stuff I listened to, because I listened to it, and she had to, whether she liked it or not. But I tried to understand what it is that she liked and what she gravitated to. And she liked bands like, you know, Macklemore and Paramore and I don't know, all those kind of bands. And it's like, well, I get it. They're her age.
Right.
Even if they're doing an old Elton John song, or if they're doing something from my generation, if it's one of those bands doing it, she loves it just as much. She just doesn't get it because they're old guys. It's old guy music. Yeah, that's what her friend says. Your dad's in a band? Yeah, what kind of music do they do? She goes, is it old guy music? She's like, yeah.
Well, I don't think it's old guy music, Randy. I can't thank you enough for the time. I know that we're hearing some stuff in the background. It's probably time to sound check soon. Let people know where they can best connect to you. I know you're active on Facebook and stuff like that.
Well, you know, I have a website, randygeorgemusic.net, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter. But I'm not a big social network hound. You know, I post things that are relevant and strictly music.
Right.
You know, I don't post what a terrible day I had, or right. I don't do anything like that. I just don't get that. But I did
seeing the picture of you and John Lodge. It gave me a good feeling.
Yeah, it was a blast hanging out with John Lodge, the one guy who I never tried to be like and ended up being a lot like. I mean, my music, Moody Blues, imprinted in a huge way, but I was always trying to be Yes or the Dixie Dregs or somebody, you know. It never occurred to me to try to be the Moody Blues, but you know, in Agilon, it's all like people, oh, it sounds like the Moody Blues, and I'm like, well, I guess it does. It's like, oh man, I have to have make a real conscious effort to not sound like the Moody Blues sometimes, and it bothers me a little bit because it wasn't ever my intent to do that. So
I think music is sort of like it comes out of you because of all your influences, and that was an influence.
Well, what goes in eventually comes out. That's
computer talk.
Yeah, exactly. Well, or you know, good prog in, good prog out. But the bottom line is, you know, somebody I can sum it out very easily. Somebody made a comment on a post not too long ago, and they says, "I can hear five of my favorite bass players in Randy George." It's like, well, that makes perfect sense because my playing is probably a culmination of, you know, five of my favorite bass players or whatever, you know. A little John Lodge, a little Chris Squire, a little Mike Rutherford, a little bit of Geddy Lee. A little bit of Jeff Berlin. Yeah, well, I respond to something. If I hear something that's, if I'm playing something that sounds like Yes, then it might sound a little bit like Chris Squire because that's how I'll approach it. It's just that kind of idea. And I do that with Neil's music a lot. You know, it's like, this is a very Genesis type section. So I'll kind of throw in a little bit of Mike Rutherford vibe, you know, or this, you know, I'm always looking for some way to kind of push the Rush vibe a little bit. It's a little tougher because Neil's not a big Rush fan, but Mike and I are, you know, so yeah, I just try to respond to what we're doing in a way that, You respond with what you know. And if it sounds like that to you, you'll probably respond with something like that because that's your frame of reference. And if you guys know how we work, then you know that we name our section, there's the Genesis section or there's the King Crimson section, you know. We'll name songs like that because that's what it reminds us of. Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. I had a good time and hope you enjoyed listening.